G'day everyone, and welcome to the show. And today we've got back on the show Michael Lee Hill. Michael, how you going, mate?
Doing fantastic. I'm really happy to be back on the air with you, Peter. You know, it was really interesting. I totally forgot today was Thanksgiving, but I think it's perfect. You know, because I know in Australia you're like, what the hell is Thanksgiving? actually, now that I found out that I got Native American heritage, I'm not so sure about my own feelings about Thanksgiving over here. But that's a whole other story.
Yeah, well, happy Thanksgiving if it means anything. But yeah, thank you for taking the time out on the holiday and coming back on the show, which I believe we're going to go into some pretty interesting things.
I'm just blowing the lid off of it, man. You know, since we last spoke, so many revelations and so many downloads of communication that have been given to me to share with the world. So I'm really thankful for that opportunity to do that. So thank you.
No worries, mate. I'm more than happy to produce a format to get this information out there. You've got a blog going. You've had that compilation video go up on YouTube. You got many things going on. Where would you like to start? And also, lately you met up with a Native American tribe member that you had a lot of sort of awakening stuff go on there as well. Because we've been talking on and off since I've had you on the show. You'll send me some documents or give me updates and that. Where would you like to start with this?
Yeah, it's you know, I think the best thing is I'll just give a little synopsis so people know who I am why I'm even on your show, and then we'll get into you know, I just put up a new website, and like you were saying, one of the coolest things to me is being able to have a blog to release my research and actually just information I'm learning through my network of people, you know, since being on the History Channel and meeting a lot of people like yourself and, you know, David Sarita and everything. It's like being able to talk with these people, there's a lot of information that hasn't even really been released yet. So it's cool to be able to share what I'm learning with the world through my own website blog. So first of all, I'll tell you that's michaelleehill.net. And check it out. Go to the blog section. And also there's a section on my music. I'm mainly a musician, and the UFO stuff was just because they decided to knock on my door, you know. And the other side of it is the UFO research, and I got a nice compilation up there of all my best footage of this light. You know, I heard that the exact same thing is over in Australia. They call them Min Min lights.
Yeah, the Min Min lights are more smaller lights that hang around the ground more. Very similar, but that to me, they would be more not the big orbs that you and I film. Though what you're getting, I'm been filming here, so there's, you know, lots of footage of that up that I've got. So it's very much the same stuff. But the Min Min lights were sort of more smaller orbs that were sort of lots of stories in the outback where they'll think it's trucks or cars flying across the road and, you know, they're these weird ass orbs that are just going off their head, buzzing around, and that's been reported going back, you know, years and years and years, and it's continuing today. So, and you've got,
you know, what's fascinating about that, because the different sizes are actually the exact same phenomenon. I learned from them. They said, you know, I've this is good because I know people that, like yourself and people that are listening to you, they know what the Merkaba is, mm-hmm. You know, the energy field around a living being. And what I've found out is if one person ignites their Merkaba field, it's going to end about 3 feet above their head and about 3 feet below their feet. So if a person is 6 foot tall, you're going to end up with a 12 foot ball of light, mm-hmm. and which would account for like the car size orb of light. But then three of those individuals that are all creating Merkaba fields can come together into a triangular formation. This is backed up by the UK Ministry of Defense as well. And those three people have a basketball size ball of physical material that's gold, iridium. Mm-hmm. I have the other components written down, but and since all three individuals are creating such high energy fields by creating Merkabas, they start willing. First of all, this person said, Michael, you know how physical matter is truly light that's been reduced down to a slower speed. So he said, imagine the physical material that's closest to becoming light. Again, in his own words, he said, it's screaming to become light again. So these three individuals start willing massive amounts of energy into this ball of physical material who already wants to become light again. They hit over a maximum threshold, and that basketball size of material actually ignites into a miniature sun in between them. Then they can take that miniature sun, and because of three people creating their Merkaba fields, it creates a bigger gridwork of sacred geometry to then stretch that light out beyond themselves and create like a 50-foot sphere of light that three beings are inside of. And now what happens is at that point you have a 50-foot sphere of light that has three beings inside of it, right? Well, three of those spheres, so you're talking nine people, right, can come together, and those nine people making three 50-foot spheres in a triangular formation. The UK Ministry of Defense said exactly what this person was. Arcturian, by the way, who is relaying this information. It can become a physical triangular craft that accounts for these triangular craft that are up to hundreds of feet long. And lo and behold, that's exactly what the UK Ministry of Defense has released recently.
And you said that document not too long ago, too.
Yeah. And before I was led to the UK Ministry of Defense, I had all this written down from my Arcturian contactee. And he's the one also here that told me he's here. The reason we even met is he knew about my bloodline. And I had asked him, I said, well, how did you know? Did you see the History Channel show? Which, again, I should give a synopsis here. But I was on the History Channel because I filmed these orbs of light over Lake Erie. And they ended up doing some blood work on me from a Harvard professor in Boston. And it was revealed that I don't have normal human blood. So it's all kind of come into what we're talking about. But back to the Min-Min lights, you know, just because they're 10 foot, you know, you can have anything from smaller orbs of light to some really huge craft. And I think it's really fascinating, though, with the Bigelow investigator telling me, and it's become pretty well known that at the Skinwalker Ranch, they've seen the orbs of light taking on physical manifestations. That's why
I've seen the beings that you and I interact with go from orbs into projecting and manifesting into human light beings. Whether they're a liquid light, still see-through, but then they go back into orbs.
You know what I'm really starting to find out is they can become anything.
Anything
they can become
exactly.
a wolf, a deer, a porcupine, you know. Yeah. But, you know, on the flip side of that, you got the UK Ministry of Defense and my Arcturian contactee saying not only can they become biological, which is, to me, way more impressive than becoming a spaceship, because that's just technological, right? Mm-hmm. But they can become anything technological or biological, which, man, that's a brand new thing to start wrapping your head around.
Well,
you
that's
know?
What was hard for me to take on board with my experiences, because the being that I originally started interacting with appeared as a female and then later showed herself in a true nature and she was a light being. And then later on, I've been on a craft with her and other beings where they've created the craft by thought, similar to what
Perfect.
You're talking about. And I was one of them on the craft. And if I looked at the ground, It was almost looked like a disc that was made out of liquid white light with a tinge of blue. But if I looked at the ground, I would see the bottom of the craft. But if I defocused, I could see the roof of my house. So and I don't know how I was perceiving this. This is the weird thing for me. I know I'm in a human body at the moment, but in that state, I don't know how I perceived what I was seeing and how that was being done. How I was taking this in, but I was one with them and I was one with the craft, as the craft was a projection of us with our oneness. So this is where, you know, I'm very impressed too with the nature of how they can make stuff that's, you know, they can turn into biological whatever, you know, they can do whatever they want, like you're saying, which is, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah, isn't it? You know what's really cool with this is you know, Bob Dean, which I'm a huge fan of, and people that don't know who Bob Dean is, just look into him. He's a high-ranking whistleblower from NATO, and but he's come forth and said a lot of people now are hip to that President Eisenhower in 1954 had meetings with three or four different races of extraterrestrials, and Bob Dean said one of those races were the Anunnaki by name. You know, he put it out there, and he said it scared the shit out of our people because the ship didn't land. It came down and just hovered over the runway for 4 days while these meetings were happening, and the Anunnaki didn't get out of the ship and walk down a runway and enter their building. They just manifested in the building, like just demanifested in a ship, remanifested right out of nothing, thin air, right in the room. And when they spoke, they didn't speak with their mouth. It was all telepathic.
That's how it's for me. That's everything you've said. That's exactly how it's been for me.
Well, it's pretty fascinating because it's almost too much for them back in 1954, you know. So it's cool to hear that you are having the same experiences. I've had them show up as people to me. And matter of fact, one of them, he took the form of a Mayan elder who entered my life. And he said, Michael, I only take this form so we can sit here and have this conversation, so it's something you can comprehend. He said, what I truly am, and he's pointed up to the sky, you know. And so, yeah, they can, I think,
I'm getting absolutely
they can become anything.
Smashed as you're saying that energetically. what we'll do, just we'll go into a bit more of a synopsis on yourself. For starters, you're a musician. You've got a lot of work out there. You've been doing that for a long time. You started filming Lights Over Lake Erie, which in itself, when people can try and debunk it, whatever, you're filming stuff near a nuclear power plant since 9/11, which is not a no-go zone, any nuclear power plant. You've got lights, multiple lights at the same time, doing stuff that just cannot be done, you know, with planes or helicopters. I've seen a lot of the footage myself, which is very similar to what I've been filming and others around the world have been filming. And it's not just once, it's been multiple times. You've had the blood test done on the History Channel, which showed through the roof readings of creatine levels, which another experience of Tyrell, I think his name is, who used to be in the military, got discharged, which we surmised through this anomaly. And just for fun, they thought they'll test you and you had the same marker in the blood, which was the anomaly. He was filming the same stuff as you, which is just trippy within itself. And in time, you had experiences with beings that presented themselves as human and some different types, like you've gone into, as the Anunnaki. You've been on lots of TV shows and news channels about this with the footage. Is that sort of just a nutshell? Is there anything else you want to add in there quickly?
No, that's pretty much it. You know, all I want to say is... the time frame of what we're talking about is the UFO Hunters show aired in early 2008. Late 2007 is when the blood work and stuff was happening in Boston with a Harvard professor. His name was David Systrom. And what I want to make clear is at this time, I was agnostic. Pretty much, you know, I just knew, there, you know, I started to understand some things about, I don't know how to put it, but it's not a coincidence that things are perfectly, like planets are perfectly aligned from one another, where that Goldilocks zone where, you know, there can be life even. And I thought, well, that's a marker of there's design behind the creation, you know. Didn't claim to know who the designer was, but I started to see proof all over just through my actually love of science. But the science path led me to this conclusion that their conclusion was, well, it's all just random, haphazard coincidence that life even evolved. And I didn't agree with that. So I went down a corridor that led me to a conclusion that I couldn't subscribe to. So it wasn't until all this started to break open, and actually due to their own guidance of leading me to beds of information, which the first one that really changed my life, and still to this day, if I was going to tell anyone to look into any bed of information, it would be the Seth material, which was channeled by a lady named Seth Jane Roberts, I'm sorry. And I was guided to this information. It's all about mental energy and how our beliefs create reality, you know. And that changed my life. But I started being guided into the same bed of information now that's making it to the world and like movies like What the Bleep Do We Know and The Secret and, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But this is back in the 60s, and it's in detail to the point that now quantum physicists are going back and studying the Seth material because they realized it was accurate. That's how the contact actually started. Is they almost gave me a course of study of how mental energy creates our physical experience. And once I understood that, and not only understood it, because you can read the books all day long and actually know it all, but unless you try to start incorporating, yeah, it's a whole different ballgame, ain't it? Yeah. When you have to start weeding out your own fear-based thought forms, because fear wears many masks. And it always appears very real to the person, you know what I mean? So to address those own things within your own psyche is not an easy thing, and it brings up a lot of pain. But, you know, what they told me was we need to realize that thoughts have an electromagnetic reality. We're broadcasting like a radio station, and what we're broadcasting is emotional information and frequency. And if something has frequency or energy, we already know with our physics that energy can't be created or destroyed. It needs to be transmuted.
It goes from one to another, yeah.
Yeah, so no one's really asked the question, how do you negate a negative thought form? Which is really what we're finding out because of Dr. Emoto and work of, you know, that lower frequencies or the thought forms that go against evolution, against the life force, doesn't create geometry. Higher thought forms create beautiful snowflake-like images in the water. So how do you transmute a negative thought form? You live it. It comes up in our own personal realities, so hopefully we'll choose love. Because if it's still coming up in our own personal awareness and experience field, it's because we still believe it. And it needs to be healed. And, you know, unless you heal it, you'll go, well, why does this same shit keep happening to me? It's different people, it's different circumstances, but it's the same thing. And once you change that and go, you know what, maybe there's another way of looking at this that's more love-filled, then you see your own reality change. That's a truth that comes from within. Like, no books or religions needed, you know?
Well, that's where I look at things and go, what can I learn from this? Because more than ever... And the more you awake, the more baggage you realize you have, because the more you see things for what they are. And this is where you go, well, this is really a projection of my own illusion, because this is an illusion at one state, but you can manipulate it if you know that. So if you've got something negative, you can live through it, go through it, work through it, and then come out the other side. And there are little lessons throughout all this. So... You know, and it's the same when you realize that you can tap into your Merkaba body, that type of thing, which I had done before, but I didn't realize what it was until, like, I think earlier this year or late last year. And then talking to you, you opened my mind up, and this is where my own limitations, just like yours and everyone else's, is us holding us back. That's our limitation. Nobody else holds us back except for us. And this is where we have to work through ourselves. So... you know, that I just find that fascinating what you just said about how do we work through that? How do we transmute that? And you're right on about that. You've got to go through it.
Let me share something with you, because when I was learning these things and I learned that our mental energy was creating our physical reality, the next thing that I realized is how come my own negative internal dialogue is always so negative? You know, I'm just being very honest with you. You know, like I when an experience would come up, this voice would be in my head, oh, this is happening again. Oh man, I'm getting screwed again. And I thought, wow, am I just doomed to keep experiencing my own negative mental energy? That sucks. You know what I mean? And I asked the big man upstairs. I put out a plea to the universe. I needed to understand this. And that night, I had a vision, and what they gave me was like a huge record player. Like one of those old time when it had a horn and a needle that went down on the record. Yeah. And it was almost like a download. Like it was the image of the record player. But at the same time, it was telling me how there's an infinite amount of parallel realities from light to dark in any instance, in anything that we experience. So what it said was, it's just a recording. And I got it. Like, it's just what I have a fear stamp on out of all the possibilities out there is what is being recorded back to me. And what I was told by the Anunnaki then is that we don't understand. We truly are part of a mass consciousness. And that, like the 100th monkey thing, if people don't know what that's about, Google 100th monkey. It just proves that life forms are connected with a mass consciousness. So what they told me was the first thought form in our own heads, in our own voices, is the thought form from the mass consciousness. The mass consciousness right now is filled with fear and doubt. So, you know, what do you do with it? Well, to me, they just said, just realize it's just a recording and see what else is available. Because the point is, if you don't look for something else, you will live that first thought form, and it's gonna suck, right? You know, and
but that's spot on. That is so spot on.
Well, Bruce Lee had another method, and I think it's explaining the exact same thing we're talking about. But Bruce Lee said that when he would have a feeling or a thought form of fear and doubt, he would write that down onto a piece of paper and then burn it and give it back to the universe and say, "Well, thank you. Now, what else is available?" You know, it's you gotta sever that connection to the mass consciousness, which is going to come through in that first internal dialogue. And once you can do that and choose a higher thought form, right? Because here's another very weird thing, that once you understand the principles we're talking about, you no longer have free will. And I know everyone talks about free will like it's a great thing, but really it's all it is the ability to choose what is not divine will. To one level or another. Once you understand that your own mental energy is creating your experience, the only proper thought form is the one that is the most love-filled outcome for everyone involved.
And any other thing, service mode too.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You got to go into, if it's just about yourself, it's not the highest thought form, you know, period. To me, that was a breakthrough because it freed me from my own negative internal dialogue and made me start to realize, you know, get beyond that and see what other possible outcomes are out there. And here's another thing. Once you come to another thought form that, you know, well, that would be a much better outcome, then don't hassle it. Don't sit there and keep wondering. Like, just said, really, we need to learn to play in our minds like we did as children, like the daydream. And instead of take any life event that's in our lives right now that you're not happy with. It could be financial. It could be relationship. Could be health issues. Anything. And then turn it around in your mind to where it would be the most best outcome that you want in that. And let yourself feel it as we did as children. Like, know what it would feel like to put that check in the bank. Live it already in your mind, like daydream, for 5 minutes. Allow yourself to experience that reality and then let it go. Because, you know, the point was brought up, well, how come only 5 minutes? Because if you do it anymore, you'll hassle it.
Yeah.
You'll start to think you're trying to change rock bed reality, you know, when indeed, if you put your mind for 5 minutes of mental focus and attention, because where we place our attention is most important, you know, and 5 minutes, if you fill your mind with beautiful, you know, thought forms of that area in your life that you want to change in, If you don't start doubting it afterwards, that new reality is streaming down the pike to manifest into your own life in the very near future. And I've used that method quite a bit for changing my own reality, and I can tell you it's worked in my own.
I've been learning very similar stuff. You met my partner before the show. You sound very similar to her in her outlook on life, and this is what's been projected into mine. And it's true what you're saying. It is so true and don't give it too much attention. And the negative things, recognize but move on and project where you would like things to be rather than where – even sometimes it's assuming where things are going to go, which is the negative thought. Oh, this is going to happen. But that's assuming, and you're projecting that into manifesting through thinking like that. So
– absolutely.
You're spot on about that. It's going to get others thinking, which I hope that's what this show does, is gets others thinking about this type of thing. What I'd like to go into, I want to go into some of the blogs that you've posted, some of the up-to-date information. Where would you like to go now?
You know what? Let's just start with the first blog, because I'll tell your listeners, what I did was just recently, within a month or two ago, the new website went up, and I had the ability to start releasing information through my blog. But I found it, you know, I got a lot of information to release, you know, and you know, just this has been a weird subject for me because, like I said, in 2008, I was agnostic. I'd never heard of the Anunnaki. I didn't know anything about bloodlines, and I didn't know about the Native American Indians part of any of this, and it ends up that they're very much a part of it. So from 2008 till now, there's been a ton of information that's been given to me. So it's important to me to try to go through and go, well, what's the most important thing out of all of this that I've been given? So my first blog is actually out of all of this information, what I felt was the most important. And the first thing was understanding the relationship of vibration to physical matter, because a lot of people are hip to sacred geometry, you know, which you find out that there's certain geometry, like the golden mean, the Fibonacci sequence, that they're inherent in all of the creation, from the smallest to the biggest, from the micro to the macro, that from an atom is using the exact same mathematics and the Fibonacci spirals and everything up to galaxies and every molecule in our body. So the thing is, when you start to find out then that frequency is creating geometry, well, not all frequencies create the most perfect geometries. And that this is a very important thing, because if whatever is creating the resonance field is going to set up the template for what geometry can form there. So if we're inundating ourselves with frequencies that are not the most harmonious cosmic frequencies, first of all, our bodies are not even tuned to take in those frequencies because they're not natural. You know, you'll find, picture like on a car radio. Say you knew nothing about where radio stations were, you know, in the area that you're in, but you can start at the lower frequencies and just turn the dial. And sooner or later, you're going to start to hear a station come in, and it's going to get clearer and clearer until you have the point that it's the most in focus out of all, like, but then as you keep going, it's going to get more noise into the signal, more noise, until it's nothing but noise. And then you're going to go higher and you're going to tune into another station. Likewise, with the study of cymatics, which is the study of vibration through a medium, be it sand or water, the same thing. Say you know nothing about the most harmonious frequencies, and you start with low frequencies, and you start going through a frequency sweep from low to high frequencies, and all of a sudden you start to see geometry form, and it gets more and more and more and more focused. When it gets the most focused, then look over at your meter and go, all right, what frequencies are we at? Not vice versa. You know, it's not up to us to just make up frequencies. It's like now we have the scientific ability to see what is creating the most perfect sacred geometry within this space-time continuum. What you find out is it all revolves around a frequency that is 432 hertz. And this is gets really strange by itself, because what I want to tell you is once you understand and see the work that comes out of the study of what are the most harmonious frequencies, it becomes evident that every harmonious frequency, if you take 432 and add them together, you get 9. To get any octave of any frequency, all you do is double it, you know, higher or lower. So to go to the lower octave of 432 is 216, 108, 54, 27, going backwards. So 27 hertz. To double any frequency, you double its frequency, right? So 27 and 27 is 54. 54 and 54 is 108. 108 and 108 is 216. 216 and 216 is 432. But look what's happening here. If you add every one of those numbers together, 432 equals 9. 216 equals 9. 54 equals 9. 27 equals 9. So they call it... Yeah, and not only that, when you go to, like, that's only the A note, right? Yeah. So when you go, and what you find out is, it Pythagoras knew, like when you just see where the most harmonious frequencies are, it just so happens it is where the next note in the scale will be. It's B. You know what I mean? And there you'll have perfect geometry. But our musical standard was changed to 440 hertz. And using the same scientific equipment, if you image a 440 hertz, there's no geometry. If you go to his octave, there's no geometry. If you go to the fifth of that note, there's no geometry. So all of our music and all this music that people are listening to in their iPads and iPhones and, you know, through commercials, through TV, it's all indated in the human body in unnatural frequencies that are not creating any geometry. And I can tell you, it just makes sense that, first of all, our brains are not set up to receive 440 hertz, you know. But what was happening with this was I was almost becoming pretty obsessed with into this bed of information. And by the way, this is really telling. Prince just broke his – he's never been into the internet. He didn't like it. But for the first time, he created a Twitter account and a Facebook account just very recently. And he said, I'll answer questions for 2 hours. Thousands of questions came in. He only answered one question. And it was someone asked him, should we be transmuting our music into 432? And he's all his answer was the golden standard, and he gave a link to why we should be converting our music to 432. I do want to make a note here. This gets into so many facets, but a lot of people think you can take a computer program and just lower a track that's been recorded in 440 to 432.
Can I ask you that?
It's not going to work because the information is lost anyhow. Right from the get-go, all the overtones are gone, man. You know what I mean? And lowering it back ain't going to bring them back.
It's got to be done from the source.
Yeah, right from the source. The instruments need to be tuned to 432. You know, I feel it's really important because Prince is a genius. And you find out, I'm sure you know Grant Cameron. And I've been working with Grant because he's coming out with a book on how come musicians have so much contact, you know. They pretty much what's going to be coming out is, as far as a ratio, there's way more musicians who have had contact with extraterrestrials other than the normal population. So why is that? That's a whole other subject, but it does get into it. It's proven now that music is one of the only things they've ever found that makes both hemispheres of your brain fire simultaneously. That both the creative and the analytical side has to be used to create music. It's both mathematical and geometrical and creative, you know, and there's nothing else. That anything else we do in life, people will either come from the left hemisphere or the right hemisphere. So they're really half-brained. I hate to put it that way, but that is the reality of the situation of their life lens into their world is that either going to come from the left or the right half of the brain. So from beginning, if a person is taught music, it rewires the brain on a neurological level, even, you know, from a very early age. So it makes sense to me that this group of people then are going to have more intuitive power to communicate because, you know, what I've found is they don't communicate usually just through talking with you. It comes through your life and synchronicity and divine coincidences. And, you know, and you got to be kind of, well, I say the more you pay attention, the more it grows, you know, until all doubt's taken away that something is in communication with you. But anyhow, getting back to why 432 is important in all of this, here's what the deal is. You start to find out, first of all, you know who Nikola Tesla is, right?
Yeah.
Said if you only knew the magnificence of the 3, 6, and 9, then you would have a key to the universe. What's that mean, right? You know, that's a pretty huge statement.
Yeah.
Even Hendrix, if 6 was 9, is interesting. The Arcturian contactee I met long ago, he said, pay close attention to the 3, 6, and 9 because it's a sequence of God. When I met this Shinto master, he's 77 years old from Japan, and I asked him his name. He said, I have 47 names. One of them is 369. I was like, wow, that's interesting, you know. So getting back to 432, we know that what we're talking about, these number sequences, harmonious frequencies, were actually given to humanity and encoded back even into the pyramids. And it's in Sumeria, we're all of a sudden, right out of the gate, we're given a counting system of that based things off of 12, you know, dividing things by 12 in particular. And you can think of 12 months, 12 hours of the clock, 12 days of Christmas, 12 inches and a foot, 12 apostles of Christ, 12 constellations of the zodiac, 12 gates of the underworld, 12 ordeals of Gilgamesh. The list just goes on. 12 tribes of Israel. There's 12 advisors to the Dalai Lama. It's 12, 12, 12, you know. So let's just do an experiment then. If they're telling us that, we should be paying close attention that when you have a unit, what is it when it's divided by 12? So what happens when you divide today's musical standard of A, 440 hertz by 12, what you get is 36.66666666. First of all, it's really interesting because let me tell you, if you do the exact same thing with 432, and anyone can do this, just get a calculator out and do 432 divided by 12, guess what it is? 36, even, perfect number. Divide 440 by 12, you get 36.66666666. I heard it perfectly said that 440 is a frequency pretending to be sacred geometry, that 440 hertz is the closest one can come to the real thing while still being an imposter. Because think of this. First of all, this is very strange because really by listening or performing the music that's been recorded in 440, you're taking on 666 onto your waveform. Well, that sounds familiar, don't it? The mark of the beast. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I wasn't religious, but I'm like, this is getting a little strange, you know?
Yeah, it does get... Yeah, a little trippy, doesn't it?
Yeah. But then I was trying to think of the significance because they were telling me it's very important to think of these numbers divided by 12. So in my mind, I'm thinking, what is the significance of 36? Because it's not 34. If it was following a Fibonacci sequence, it would be 34 mm-hmm. and not 36. So in my mind, and I'm going, what's the significance of 36? And all of a sudden, I realize all my other research into the most harmonious numbers, when they're added together, they all equal 9. Mm-hmm. Well, what's 3 and 6 when it gets added together? 9.
And even if you go 3, 6, you get 9 there. Plus the 9, you get 18. 8 plus 1, you get 9.
Yes,
so
indeed.
It all comes back to that, yeah.
So really what is being said, and they told me that this revealing of this information to the world is of the significance of Einstein's revealing E equals MC squared. It's a simplistic equation, and it is 432 hertz equals 369. No way around it. It's right there in the math that 369 is just another way of saying 432. Which is mind-blowing, right? What you find out is, here it is. In 1936, the American Standard Association recommended A above middle C would be 440. And check this out. This is Confucius. He said, if one desires to know whether a kingdom is well-governed or not, if its morals are good or bad, the quality of its music will furnish the answer. He's not talking about if people were writing songs like the Beatles.
Yeah.
The quality of music is what frequencies they were performing their music in, and the importance of 432. 432 hertz was also known as Verdi's A, which was an alternative tuning method that is mathematically consistent with the universe, which we're finding out. Music based on 432 transmits beneficial healing energy because it is a pure tone of math fundamental to nature. So it gets into 442, you know, it's pretty much it just says that, you know, with 440, you're inundating the body with, says just go out and look in the street. What do you see? School kids, young adults on their way to work, women pushing their babies in a stroller, a man walking his dog. And what do they all have in common? iPads or MP3 players in their ears, you know? So I don't know really how to go you know, it's kind of taking care of itself, brother, because I'm thinking, how do you tell the world that you need to change the musical? Why would anyone even care? Well, when you have Prince, people like Prince's stature relating this. But what happened was, because of all this, I ended up hiring a company that does the imaging of frequencies in a physical medium, in this case, water, and they're called cymoscope. And the field is called cymatics, which cyma means wave, and it's the study of wave phenomena within a physical media. And so I hired them to make an image of my own guitar recorded in stereo, and I had it tuned to 432. And it's, I would have never thought this in a million years, but already, because I only had this done about 3 months ago, well, I shared the image with Nassim Harriman. Well, first of all, let me back up, because the actual people who created the cymatic equipment were just blown away. They contacted me back, and first of all, they asked me for my permission to make, for them to use my full 20-second audio file that I sent them of my guitar as an experimental video to show it in happening in real time. And I've not seen that yet myself. They're still working on it. So that's going to be interesting in itself. But they said, we've never seen this kind of complexity and geometry formed by anything we've ever imaged in the past. And what I received back was an monstrous 3,000 by 3,000 image. That's 4.1 megabytes of resolution for this image. So it is a beautifully high detailed image, and it is seriously breathtaking. So I shared it with Nassim Harriman. He flipped out over it and shared it through his own webpage and the Resonance Project, which he is the director of. And lo and behold, like, people are just being drawn to this image like mad, and it's got over, it's nearing 3,000 likes and shares on Facebook right now. So I couldn't have asked for more to break this information out. And really, I think this is what it takes, is when you see the image, which anyone, if you go to my Facebook page, I'm using it as my what's that called, the cover
picture, like the top photo, the sort of cover photo. Yeah.
You know what I'll do, though? I want to do this for you. I'm going to share the full resolution image with you to share with your viewers.
Awesome.
And you can share that on your website, and you can see. Here's one really strange thing. Now, picture this, that what you're seeing, like what they gave me, is just one still frame. Say for film, there's anywhere, depending where you're at, like say 29 frames per second. And I got one frame of 20 seconds. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So in this one picture that they sent me, there's no doubt that there's binary code in it, which how the hell is binary code being formed by nothing but a frequency from my guitar coming through a rock guitar amp, a Joe Satriani amplifier, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And just by nothing but that frequency being pumped through water, is there an image that encodes binary? That blows my mind in my own head. But the problem is that you'll see in the image, it's got this shape that is surrounding the whole package, almost like an egg, mm-hmm. around the image, around it. And there's one part of that shell that comes towards you, and the next part goes back away from you, like three-dimensionally. So you can only see the binary code on the one that's facing you. The one that's facing the other direction, it just looks like dashes and behind it. Then the next one, you can see what looks to be binary code. Then, you know. So, and it's very interesting, because here's where this gets very strange in all of this. As we were saying, to get to any frequencies, octave, you just double it, mm-hmm. You know, forward or backwards. So if you go four octaves below 432 is 27 hertz. And just to go over this again, because it's important, 27, if you double it, is 54, 54, and 54, 108, 108, 108 is 216. 216, 216 is 432. So 27 hertz, you'll never get that frequency unless you – it's called a diaspan, which is where – your center note of all this is focused, and that's 432. So a 27 hertz cymatic image, and I only know this because of my work into this, and I was creating these works. I call them Anunnaki healing energy discs, and I'm making them available on my website, by the way. People can just go there and go to the shop, and I put it in one of the blogs is about this too, because it's revealing something very profound, and I think you'll get this as far as it deals with the UFO subject. And this is unknown at this point right now, and it's a huge revelation to mankind. So I'm glad I can share this with you and your listeners right now. First of all, you need to know that with cymatics and this field of study, what you find is the lower the frequency, the simpler the geometry. So just keep that in mind. So a 27 megahertz hertz A produces what looks like a seven-pointed symbol, a star, a seven-pointed star. Mm-hmm. And I had the cymatic image of this 27 hertz A, and I had the whole musical scale in that four octaves below 432 because it's creating simpler geometry to look at, you know? So I'm sitting here looking at this 27 hertz, seven-pointed star cymatic image, and something in my mind is just going, why does this look so familiar to me? What the hell is going on, you know? And all of a sudden, I looked over, and I had created one of these disks out of the inky crop circle that showed up in Italy in 2011. And I'm going, holy shit, it's the inky crop circle. The inky crop circle is a seven-pointed star right in the middle of that. It's the featured thing in that whole crop circle. If you go look at the inky crop circle, the middle of it is a seven-pointed star. Look at a cymatic image of four octaves below 432. It's the exact same image.
Yeah.
Then you find out that it's the Babylonian star map that's in museums right now. Go look at it. It's a seven-pointed star. And then, so I'm starting to understand then, like, well, holy shit, this inky crop circle has a 432 derivative encoded into it as well. Not only is it encoded the names Ia Inki with binary code around the outside of it, it's got a 432-based cymatic image into the middle of it. And so this left me with this point of understanding there must have been some huge significance to the seven-pointed star because it's been used throughout history, even back in Babylonia. You know, the Babylon world map is it, and it is inky, you know. So I'm sitting there trying to just wrap my head around this, and then I get offered to go to the Star Knowledge Conference, which you were saying, but what I want to tell you is the Star Knowledge Conference is put together by the chief of the Sioux Indian Nation. His name is Chief Golden Light Eagle. And he has been on the Ancient Aliens History Channel show talking about the Native American contact with star visitors. He met me at a conference that I was speaking at and he was at called Angels and Aliens. He walked up to me afterwards and he didn't even know of my Indian heritage or anything. And he said, would you come and speak at the Star Knowledge Conference? I need your energy there and I need the Nephilim ambassadors to be present. I was like, wow, okay, you know. So when I got there, I didn't even know really, dude, what I was, I'd heard of the Star Knowledge Conference, but didn't really know, because I just found out because of the History Channel revealing I don't have normal human blood. They said, well, you should contact your biological parents if you can. So for the first time in my life, late 2008, I met my biological mother for the first time and my two sisters. That's when I found out that my, actually, up until this point, I thought it was my great-grandfather, and it's not. I just found out it's my great-grandmother, who is a pure-blood Seneca Indian of the Iroquois tribe. And this gets into a really fascinating thing. I'm glad we're getting into this. But the whole point is, when I got there, it was all of the elders, chiefs, and you find out that it's the grandmothers who run everything in the Native American cultures, that everything goes up to the chief, and they have control up until if something of any great importance, then it goes to the grandmother, that the females have the power over the whole cultures. And that's so it keeps everything equal. It was all of the elders. It was all the chiefs from like the Sioux, the Cherokee, the Aztecs, the Mayans, all the representatives from all the tribes were there.
So what the hell was going through your mind when you realized this?
Well, it even gets weirder because some of the things that went down there just have blown my mind still, and the repercussions are still happening to this day. Yeah. Because what happened, first of all, let me tell you, just meeting all these people and being able to be in their energy, I'm going to back up because meeting all these people were fantastic. But right next to me, because I had a table there set up so I could sell DVDs and my CDs and these crystals and whatnot. So the chief sat next to me, his name was Bear Cloud, Chief Bear Cloud, and he had a book that was written with had all this knowledge that had been handed down throughout the Native American Indian cultures. And I go to his book and I just start flipping through it. And first of all, he's a master artist. This guy, his paintings look like Salvador Dali level stuff. It's just mind blowing. And all of a sudden I start seeing all this information about the seven pointed star. And I was like, holy crap. I knew I had to buy the book right then and there, right? So when I get home, I'm reading it. And he says, when mankind understands the significance of the seven-pointed star, it will usher mankind into a new state of evolution, because it practically, like fractals, you know, in the world of fractals, a seven-pointed star can reproduce itself infinitely forwards or backwards, mathematically, perfectly, and create another seven-pointed star. When you zoom in on that, it'll be another seven-pointed star. And so right now I'm in the process of reading that book, because what he shows is, picture if you have a seven-pointed star, mm-hmm. it's actually the layout of the pyramids in Giza fit what, like if you put the seven-pointed star with one of the stars down, the pyramid fits up perfectly in it, and all the shafts and everything that are inside the Grand Pyramid line up to the seven-pointed star geometry. It's all related, and so really you're starting to get the blueprint of how these things were created when you start to see the significance of the seven-pointed star. It's no coincidence that that seven-pointed star is encoded into the inky crop circle. But then you know what I did? I took the inky crop circle, because I'm making these crystal discs that I was telling you about. Yep. And I think that this is a technology that is so cool for this, because it's not technology-based. You can hold a crystal disc in one hand. And I do this with people. I made a disc that had a cymatic image of a 440 frequency, mm-hmm. and then the other one, 432. You don't have to explain anything to anyone. You just hand them two discs, and you go, oh, okay, I get it. You know what I mean? So what I did was I took the 27 hertz, seven-pointed star cymatic image, and layered it with the inky crop circle, and put the seven-pointed star of the inky crop circle perfectly inlaid into the inky seven-pointed star. What I found out is all the other components of the inky crop circle are other components of the cymatic image of the 27 hertz. You see what I'm saying? Like, so that disc itself, when you hold it up to the light, you can see all the information of both the cymatic image and the inky crop circle superimposed over one another. And it was quite profound. Actually, when I realized all this, it brought tears to my eyes, which I've not had a revelation like this in a very long time that just hit me of such magnitude. If that doesn't tell people that it was real. But let me tell you the significance of the inky crop circle to myself. It's very long ago, like you said, I was on the History Channel, and they revealed I didn't have normal human blood. And that very same day, they're like, okay, you're going to have a plane waiting to leave here soon, and we're going to have you on your way. I'm like, wait a minute. This isn't a TV show. You just told me I don't have normal blood, and you're just going to send me off? And the Harvard professor is like, what do you think unknown means? We don't know what to tell you. He said, if I had to hypothesize that, what I would think is maybe it's some kind of virus. He said, all viruses aren't bad, that they can work on the level of DNA, that some kind of unknown virus is tricking the body into releasing massive amounts of creatine kinase, and it's done from childhood, so your body just kind of readjusts the other things, because it's going to affect everything with blood sugar levels and everything in the blood if you have that much creatine kinase. Because, like, you'll find people that have diabetes, the medicine that they give them increases creatine kinase. So it's almost like if you check my blood sugar levels, they're also very increased, to the point that people would think I was going to go into a diabetic shock. Yeah. But it's not, because my body is just adjusting adapted to the creatine kinase levels.
Do you know your actual blood type at all?
No. You know, a lot of people ask me that, and I know I should know it. I was such a baby growing up. I have almost like a needle phobia. I never gave blood. And I don't get sick often, so I very rarely have even been to the doctor. It wasn't until the History Channel, and they didn't tell me I was going to have my blood work done. I probably would have said no. But they just said, you know, originally they just were going to do a show on sky gazers, sky watchers, and I was going to be on there for 5 minutes. They didn't know that 2 weeks before coming to see me, they'd meet Terrell, and Terrell would have filmed the exact same UFOs I had, had the same story of contact, and had this blood anomaly that he was dismissed from the military, you know, honorary discharge. Yeah. So it was their own brilliance, actually, of going,
all that worked out.
Yeah, what if these two guys shared that same unknown blood anomaly? That would be weird. So they didn't tell me that. They just said, hey, we've decided, can we do an update to your segment, and would you be able to fly to Boston? I'm like, why am I going to Boston? It wasn't until I got to Boston that I found out it was to go to the Boston General Hospital. Yeah, so that's when all this unfolded.
That's trippy. I only just recently found out I'm Rh positive, not negative. Rh positive, and apparently people out there are saying, oh, the negative and the positive are some abduction markets. I don't have a clue, but that's what I've just found out. I just thought I'd ask you anyway. Just to find out anyway.
I never knew because, you know, I never had my blood work done, and I did just get my medical work from I asked them for a copy of it, and there's no mention on there. First of all, I asked them for the results of the blood test because I know that they said my levels were almost identical, which was approximately 2,100, where the normal levels are 25 parts per liter of blood for normal human for creatine kinase or kinase. My levels and Terrell's were right around 2,100. The NSA people have brought me aboard, the guys that teach the remote viewing and whatnot. They said that within their group, they had 12 members of my bloodline, and that the highest being 12,000, or me being that. They said my numbers would put me in the middle of those 12 that they have. And he told me that the guy with 12,000 got hit by a particle beam weapon by Team Bad Cop, if you want to look at it that way, and that he was able to get up and kind of brush it off and walk away from it, you know, the kind of hinting at that normally that wouldn't happen. So I guess the more of, you know, because really what happens is creatine kinase is released into the body. It brings chi. It brings extra life force in the way of oxygen into the bloodstream. That's
the
why
muscles,
creatine,
when the muscles break down, like after doing weights or exercise, doesn't it?
Or anything to do with, like if you have a heart attack or you tear a muscle or anything, then your brain releases extra creatine kinase into the bloodstream to bring oxygen to facilitate healing. Yeah. And even the normal levels are 25 parts per liter of blood. If you've had a heart attack or muscle damage, it can jump up to about 250 to about 300 tops. Even that's like damage numbers, is gets up to about 300. So you can imagine 2,100. Yeah. But the thing is that there's like the people that teach the men who stare at goats kind of people, they told me that just because someone has this bloodline and has this extra chi pool available, it might just lay dormant because they haven't learned how to work with chi, or, you know, like they're not Qigong masters or whatever you call those guys that can work it with chi, you know. I would think that, you know, the only thing I've pretty much used it for is, you know, I have learned to picture this, dude. I don't know. My brain's just going off. I have too much coffee, but think about, if we're talking about manifesting and focusing your intention on something that you want to manifest, what happens when you teach yourself to mentally chant a 432 frequency? It's not that hard. That a crown chakra Tibetan singing bowl are tuned to 432. So if you got a Tibetan singing bowl and just every day get it to sing, and then you chant that frequency along with your bowl, and then don't play the bowl, just do it mentally. And get to the point where you can sing 432 internally, inside your own head, not verbally, not through your mouth, but you can sing 432 internally. And then as you're singing and chanting internally, you're visualizing the seven-pointed star, which is the geometry of 432, four octaves below. I think there's a secret here, you know, that I'm starting just right now to do these things and to meditate and try to manifest while focusing my mental energy into these harmonious frequencies and geometries.
Imagine with doing all that with positive thoughts at the same time and positive intent.
Yeah.
And focus on whether it's connecting or healing yourself or, you know, whatever of a positive nature. It's just going to be amplified by so much.
Yes, indeed. I think there's, and you know, I think it's so important for us. Like you said, you're getting together with friends and playing music and drumming and what needs to be added to the drumming though? Drumming is great. It does. Indians know it can change your state of consciousness, but there's no tone associated with drumming. What happens when you mix drumming with 432 bass frequencies? You know, I think that's the next step in what we're talking about.
Be good study.
Yeah. Well, you know, some of the flutes, now I'm thinking about it, are tuned to 432, the Native American flute. But the Indian thing, man, it just blew my mind because I'm finding out they know, you know, because all this, let me tell you, after all this started to happen and, you know, because of my contact with the NSA insiders, which actually are the Lockheed Martin Skunk Works division. You know, they're the ones that do the secretive work for Lockheed Martin, who makes all the, you know, stealth fighters and, you know, everything for the government. Man, it just there's so much to get into, and I don't want to get too scattered here. Let me get back to the Indians. What's happening is it's the Nephilim. Because what I was saying is with the NSA people, they pulled me into a meeting with about 8 high-ranking members of the Templars and, you know, people. And they said, we want to have a talk with you, because they shut down a TV show at the last moment. It was set to air in the fall of 2012. And I had worked 6 months of my life with Spike TV. And by all accounts, this show had just blown Spike TV executives' minds, because not only did they have my story, but they had me flown to New York. And when I got there, they had the chief of police for the New York Police Department ready with a polygraph test, a lie detector test. I didn't know this, but I passed it with flying colors. And then they had a hypnotist professional, which I found out this guy was actually an Army Ranger, like Navy SEAL level cat, you know, that had been trained in psychology and in hypnosis. So afterwards, I was a little leery. I'm like, man, I let this guy poke around in my head, you know. But I trust him, and I still trust him to this day, because he was really tied in with the Tibetans. And I have a lot of past life recall of living as a Tibetan monk. And it gets interesting because, what I was going to tell you, this is so important. I'm glad I remembered this. With the Inky Crop Circle, and why this is important to me, is because of being on the History Channel and them revealing the blood issue, it was 6 months later, pretty much after that show aired, that I was met by the Anunnaki face to face. And they told me that they wanted to talk to me about this blood anomaly that was revealed and what it truly means. They said, you're a part of the Nephilim bloodline, that it's a mixture of our, you know, the Elohim or Anunnaki, it's the same thing, and the human bloodline. And this is going to be revealed in the future, and pretty much you're the poster child. And I'm like, what the hell does this even mean? Because like I said, I'd never even heard of the Anunnaki. I wasn't religious. So I knew of the giants being, you know, the Nephilim being called giants or whatever. But what I asked them, because they told me of my connection to Inky, and they said, you're Inky's human counterpart. Put it this way, they said the Nephilim, this bloodline that was created that has this extra creatine kinase, the creatine kinase was needed to bring more chi in, because long ago when they decided, which gets into the whole story of the last flood and one of them going to bat for humanity, because their race was going to let us perish in the flood, and Inky wasn't cool with this because he was the scientist that actually did the genetic manipulations to create Homo sapien. And he looked at us as family, and he's like, well, what had happened, as we said, his mother was not Anunnaki. See, I'm going to get lost off. Let me get back to that, because the whole point is they told me about my own connection to Inky. Yep. And they said the Nephilim bloodline was created because it was put into motion a long time ago that an experiment would be put into place to help mankind evolve at a faster rate as an experiment. Like, we would experience our own mental energy, both dark and light, in an accelerated fashion, in an unbiased way, for us to process that information at a quicker rate. Because what had happened is, when Inky went to his mother's side and said, my race is going to let this beautiful upcoming race of consciousness just perish and not even try to lift a finger. And that's where Noah's myth comes from and the building of the ark. But what isn't told in the story is, they said, well, even if we do build this ark and save humanity from the flood, are they going to evolve fast enough for the end of this grand cycle that's closing in 2012, which at that time was a long time in the future? But the answer was no, because even in the Sumerian tellings, humanity was brought into the Eden. That was their word for it. Well, that sounds familiar, right? Mm-hmm. And the first human male was Adamu, or Adam. So they said the answer was no, because in Eden, we lived side by side with the Anunnaki, and there was no homeless, there was no starvation. It was truly Eden. But because of this, we weren't evolving. We were stagnant. There was no catalyst for change. So we just kind of were more like pampered pets. Yeah, we helped with the toil and labor, but they really dug us. You know what I mean? They're like, we were pampered pets more than anything, even though some of them kind of just thought of us as just inferior life forms. Like Inky's brother Enlil was said to, he didn't even like the noises that we made, like when we were making love and stuff. He's like, it's disgusting, you know? So they said, well, what can be done if this race isn't, even if we save them, if they're just left to their own devices, there's not enough time left for them to reach the consciousness level that is needed by the end of this shift. So they put in this experiment to accelerate human conscious evolution by enabling us to experience mental energy in an accelerated fashion. So when this was done, they said, well, this has never even been tried before in the big scheme of the whole universe. This was a new thing that was happening right here on planet Earth. And they said, well, you can't just do that to an upcoming race that's never been tried before without you going through it yourself. And you need to become human and guide this experiment then from the inside. And what they found was, when they tried to incarnate into a human vessel, they would spontaneously combust, that they had too much energy for the human vessel and it didn't work out well. So then they had to go to round two and go, well, what can we do? Well, let's make a brand new human bloodline that has more chi available, you know, or more oxygen, which is exactly what the creatine kinase does, is it brings that in. So then what I'm telling you is, every single person of the bloodline, of this particular bloodline that has increased creatine kinase, there's only one explanation, is they have an Anunnaki higher self. And they said, your higher self is Inky. And at the time, like I said, I was agnostic, and I just didn't make any sense to me. So when I get this information, I began to, you know, not only did I meet them face to face, but we began to communicate telepathically and through meditation. And I asked them, I said, listen, if you are who you say you are, how about you encode the name Inky into a crop circle? And then the next thought in my mind was, well, that'll be silly. This is at the end of 2008, mind you. You know what I mean? Well, probably beginning of 2009, now that I'm thinking about it. But my next thought was, what are they going to do? Put a big crop circle with a curse of Inky written in it? That'd be pretty ridiculous. No one would believe it anyhow, you know? So lo and behold, 2011, this crop circle shows up that did have the name Inky written into it, but it was done in binary code. And I asked them at the same time that I asked them to put a crop circle in a field with the words Inky written into it. I said, and in, like, just playing in my mind, I said, and then encode it with information only I would be able to decode. Right now I just decoded the 27 hertz and how it connects to the 432, mm-hmm. and how 432 equals 369. So it's a huge confirmation for me of what's going on here. But so, first of all, now you understand what this bloodline is. But here's the deal that it's really crazy, is I was just brought to the knowledge of Edgar Cayce, which is the world's famous, most famous psychic ever, and said that his psychic readings are just off the charts in accuracy. But it comes out to, for a very long time, in these readings that Edgar Cayce would do, that these information about the mound builders and who the mound builders truly were. But to even get into this and why this is important is because I was telling you that my show was stopped by the powers that be for Spike TV, and I was doing the work with the NSA remote viewers, that they'd pulled me into their group to offer me a course of study. The head of that is truly the head of the world. It's like when extraterrestrials and technology transfers, they don't talk to Obama. He doesn't understand the physics and everything. It's the very best quantum physicists that are studying new life physics and understand how light and sound create physical reality. Those are the people that enlightened extraterrestrials are going to have a talk with. That is the gentleman who brought me into the fold, and his name was A.R. Borden. And A.R. said, Michael, the elite of the world want to have a conversation. He knew I was Inky, by the way. He said they want to have a conversation with you, and they feel that they need to tell you why this information has been withheld from humanity for the last 25 years and why your show was shut down. And pretty much in a nutshell, they just said that they don't trust humanity with free energy. Said releasing of the UFO subject, inevitably, the next question is, well, where are they coming from and how are they getting here, which leads to their propulsion systems. And then their propulsion systems leads to free energy. They said, I know it sounds great, and I'm not telling you this because I subscribe to their point of view. I'm just telling you, I'm relaying the information they gave to me because I do think it's important. They said, we know it sounds great. What people don't realize is once free energy is revealed, released on a planet, no one's excluded. It is the great equalizer, and that whether you're homeless or not, you will have access to unlimited free energy because it's unlimited and it's free. It's right there in the name of it, you know. They said, all fine and dandy, right? They said, what do you think that these groups in the Middle East who are at war with one another, that live 5 miles from one another and they're bombing each other because they just don't believe the same thing? They said, what do you think they're going to do with their unlimited free energy? You know, what do you do with a person that will take a woman that's rumored to have an affair into the middle of a village and the village comes out and stones her to death? What do you think that they're going to do with their unlimited free energy? I thought that was a really interesting point because I never really thought about that. And it does seem a legitimate thing to talk about because they said once unlimited free energy is released on a planet, if people want to misuse it, you can create a suitcase size weapon that will make a nuclear weapon look like child's play, you know, and they can't even control it. Once it's released, you know. So I thought it was an interesting thing, and I do think that that point has created a loophole for the elite to keep this information because truly it keeps their oil-based slavery system in place as well.
Keeps their paycheck coming in and their power in.
Yes, too, indeed. Yeah. I think it gave them a huge loophole to keep their agenda going. But my point was, well, we're all in agreement then that there's higher forms of intelligence at play here that are intertwined with Earth history. That why don't we talk with them? You know what I mean? Why don't we talk with a race who's learned these same lessons maybe millions of years ago in their own evolution? They learned to get past these ideas of war and abusing others' powers, and you know, maybe now they've been for a million years exploring the universe in peace, and it's like, let's see how advanced races got beyond this. You know, I don't know the answer, but I would say let's have a talk with some enlightened beings. And they said, we also want to talk to you about how everyone wanted to just give their own opinion in this roundtable group meeting I was having with these elitists, if you want to call them that, that how should first contact be handled that would create the least amount of ripples? And my suggestion was to reveal the reality of this extraterrestrial intelligence in humanity's past first. Meaning, to me, I know because of watching What Lies Underneath, which was a History Channel show on using ground-penetrating radar in Egypt, they know that most of what's there is still under the sand. there's pristine pyramids that make the ones in Giza look small. And they've never had their outer casings ripped off of them like the Giza ones did to make temples and whatnot. And there's thousands of them still lying under the sand. What happens when they unearth just one of those pyramids and let humanity go in and see a pristine pyramid? And it's, you know, it's going to be really apparent that we didn't build that, meaning early humans, you know. And I thought, that's what I thought. And I asked for them, I thought it'd be a good idea to reveal the fingerprint of this intelligence in humans' past first, because then it's not in your face. It's not like people are going to have to come to the realization, if they've been here this long, if they really meant us harm, me and you wouldn't be talking right now. If these beings have this type of technology, and so I think, first of all, revealing their intertwining in human history in our past is a good way to do it. And like I said, I thought it would be more about unveiling secret, like hidden structures. What's happening is that's not what's happening. What's happening is revealing of the Nephilim bloodline. And it's through me, because like I said, in 2008, I didn't know I had Iroquois Indian heritage. Reason I'm telling you all this is Edgar Cayce, in his readings, he said that the mound builders are actually the remnants of Atlantis, the Atlanteans, and that there was actually, he said, Atlantis broke up into three breakup periods. One was 50,000 years ago, approximately. One was 28,000 years ago, approximately. Then the last time that it actually was broken up and everything went under for the final time was 10,500 years ago. The 10,500 years ago migration from Atlantis, they went to the left and hit the bottom of what became the North American continent. And the first people that they ran into were the native Mayans. And they taught them the Mayan calendar, and they taught them pyramid building, and translate a lot of their knowledge to the Mayan people. But people were wondering what happened to the Mayans, like, because all of a sudden they just disappeared. Well, it said what happened was the Atlanteans, or Edgar Cayce called them the Poseidonians, which it's interesting because Poseidon is inky. You know what I mean? These beings have been known in many different names in different cultures. Cayce called them the Poseidonians. That when they taught the Mayans and all this there, sooner or later, darkness started to seep into their belief systems, and they started thinking that they had to do human sacrifice, you know. And so pretty much the Atlanteans, the Poseidonians, went, well, it's time to move on, you know. I don't think these people are getting it. So they traveled straight up through the interior of the United States. And what I got to reveal is just mind-blowing. But let me get back to what Edgar Cayce said. He said that those Atlanteans or Poseidonians moved up through the interior of the United States until they reached the Great Lakes area, and they started making mound structures all through New York, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. And that's the Serpent Mound, you know, the Newark Earthworks. And so what you find out, he said, then these beings then intertwined into the Iroquois tribe of Indians, which, hello, you know, right? That's, I couldn't have made this shit up. You know what I mean? It's just unfolding how it is. So what's happened with all this is because of the NSA insiders, AR told me, he said, we know you're living on top of one of the biggest vortexes in the world, in your area, that we don't even know how you could be living there. Because think of this. You find out where these mounds were, the Indians didn't live there. They went there for ceremony. They know that those are sitting on top of huge energy vortexes that amplify energy. Unbiased, man. So they would not even enter those areas unless they did ceremony and cleanse their minds of any negative, you know, fear-based thought forms before they even entered those areas, because they'll manifest very quickly. The further you are away from a vortex, the more of a delay, you know, there is in your manifestations. So I'm thinking, well, if I'm sitting on top of one of the world's biggest vortexes in this area, where's the mound? You know, where is the structure? There should be a pyramid here or something, some type of huge mound complex, and there's not. So I started thinking back. I grew up in this area, and from childhood, I remembered my mother who worked for the city of Eastlake. And the city of Eastlake, by the way, just so you know, is the place that I've filmed all these orbs of light, and the mass UFO sightings have happened. It's the exact same location of the famous 1988 Coast Guard event that happened in Eastlake, Ohio at the power plant that Richard Dolan has put into the top 10 UFO events ever. That's in Eastlake, Ohio. Well, I remember growing up in Eastlake, Ohio, that there was a talk that there was some type of mound up on the hill from where I live. So just recently I stopped there because I heard there was a little monument right at the top of the schoolyard. And I went, and sure enough, it says this was the site of the Whitsley Indian culture. And you find out Whitsley is not the name of the Indians. It's the name of the, what's that called, like surveyor in the late 1800s that was hired by the government to survey the land. His name was Whitsley. So it was just known as the Whitsley Indian culture that lived there. And so I started doing some study on that. And I released some of it on Facebook, and I get contacted by the Eastlake Historical Society. And I'm like, wow, this is interesting. They said, we have artifacts that were removed from that mound complex here at City Hall at the Eastlake Historical Society, if you would like to see them. Absolutely, you know. So I drove up there, and right on the wall is all these newspaper articles about, you know, Indians in this area, and one really caught my eye. Eastlake is the first home of the mound builders, the first location ever. Before they went to Western Ohio and built the Serpent Mound, which was just revealed, it's much older than we've ever thought. Mm-hmm. And then they built the Newark Earthworks, which you find out the Newark Earthworks has the oldest version of the Ten Commandments written in ancient Hebrew, was removed out of a mound in Newark, Ohio, not Egypt.
What the hell?
And the same geometry that's encoded into the pyramids, they're called stades, mm-hmm. which a stade is 606 feet of our, you know. So every angle of the pyramid in Giza is 606 feet. Well, in Newark, Ohio, the earthworks, when you square the circle, how surveyors do, you know, to get angles, every one of those angles is 606 feet. The slope of the pyramid is, I think it's 51.8. Don't quote me on that, but I think it is. The angle of the slope. And when you find true north in Newark, Ohio, to those earthworks, and then put to where one of these lines is, it's 51.8. The same geometry is encoded in Ohio. So what I'm finding out is they were here first. And so before they went to Samaria, before the Sumerian culture became the Egyptian culture, they were in Ohio. And so what happens is then I find out that there's an Indian museum called the Willoughby Eastlake Indian Museum. So they have a bunch of artifacts there. So I went and made a visit there, and this is where this gets really strange, because someone knows this and has encoded it into the area here. I go there, and there's this little old lady who is the curator of this museum, and she goes on to tell me that, first of all, you find out that the first Mormon temple ever, which I'm not Mormon, by the way, but I got to relay this information, that in the Mormon mythology, their prophet, Joseph Smith, met an angel, and his name was Moroni, and Moroni told him that he had lived many lives as a North American Indian, and that the North American Indians are truly one of the lost tribes of Israel. That's, you know. So when I'm at the Willoughby Indian Museum, this lady tells me that Mormons from all over the world travel here because Joseph Smith, this is his first temple, was here. He built it. He was like 2 miles from where the temple is in Kirtland, Ohio, is a park called Chapin Forest, and that's where the stone was quarried from and dragged up the hill to build the temple. And so Mormons from all over the world travel to Kirtland, Ohio to visit the first Mormon temple, but they all also make a trip to the Willoughby East Lake Indian Museum. This little old lady tells me, like, because the top of the heads of the Mormons that make these trips possible and tell them what they need to go see, they all visit the East Lake Willoughby Indian Museum because they know that they're one of the lost tribes. Well, after all this information is starting to come together in my own mind, I realize, first of all, by talking to some Indians in this area, they told me that the oldest road in this area was here long before, it's been here for thousands of years, of a migration route. And before, you know, I'm talking, obviously there's no paved roads or anything. Right now, that road still exists. And guess what the name of it is? Lost Nation. So you take Lost Nation, and you can Google this. Go to MapQuest or Google Earth and type in Lost Nation, East Lake, Ohio. And then take Lost Nation up until it dead ends where you get to Lake Erie. Now, if you go to the left, you go about a mile, and that's where the mound complex of the first location of the mound builders was. What I found out was this mound complex had mounds that were walls that were 665 foot long and 25 foot high. Can you imagine how big this place was? And it had pyramids that were flat top mounds, pyramidal structures in the inside of it. It was massive. It's like, obviously, this reality has been kept from the masses, you know. In my mind, they almost had to bulldoze it down, you know. They're like, well, we can't keep this thing up here. This is going to raise some questions. So what I'm telling you, you get to the end of the Lost Nation, take a left. In 1 mile, you're going to get to that first location of the mound builders ever in East Lake, Ohio. But as I was telling you, Edgar Cayce said that the mound builders became the Iroquois tribe of Indians. What people need to know is the Iroquois is not one single tribe. It's a confederacy. There's five tribes that make up the Iroquois tribe of Indians, and they weren't always united, and that's an interesting story in itself of how they were united. But there's five different tribes. I don't even know all the tribes, but I can tell you Seneca is because that I am Seneca. Mm-hmm. The Mohawk. And the Indians from here actually went west then, and they became the Cherokee. So the Cherokee are the Iroquois, almost like blood cousins. Mm-hmm. So what happens is when you get to the end of Lost Nation Road and you hang a right, guess what the first road you come to? Iroquois. The next road is Seneca. The next road is Mohawk. Cherokee is there. Then I come to a road called Tioga. And I'm like, well, what the hell is Tioga? I don't, you know. So I go to Google, type in Tioga. It's Iroquois Indian word for peaceful valley. This is the promised land, and it's being proven right now as we speak, because the artifacts that that they removed from these mounds were at the East Lake Indian Museum, and I took photographs of all these tablets that had writings on them. One was obviously a star. Some of them look like ley line maps. So as I'm at the Star Knowledge Conference, I meet one of the chiefs, and he's been on the History Channel Ancient Aliens show as well. His name's Clifford Mahudi. And I showed him the photographs I had just taken like a week earlier. That's how fast all this is unfolding, you know. And I showed him the pictures. He's like, will you please send these to me? Because this is what I do, is I translate these. So right now I'm waiting on word back from him. He's translating these plates that were removed from the mounds. And so now the East Lake Historical Society is really excited, because even at the museum they had a sign up where these things were displayed. It says, does anyone know what these things mean? You know? But where this gets fascinating is this isn't all hearsay now, that it's been backed up in actual DNA testing, and that comes in the form of scientists can now, using DNA scientific testing, they can trace back the lineage of any DNA back in time and see where you came from. And they call those lineages haplogroups, H-A-P-L-O group, you know, added onto it. And for Native American Indians, they found that there was five haplogroups that made up the North American Native American Indians, and they just named them A, B, C, D, and E, five of them, right? And it wasn't until 1997, which is not that long ago, they found a brand new haplogroup that was tied in with the North American Indian tribes, and it's called Haplogroup X. And anyone can go and Google Haplogroup X. And what you find out is the only place that Haplogroup X DNA is found is in the ancient skeletal remains that have been removed from these earth mounds, mostly giant skeletons, 8 to 16 feet tall.
Jeez.
And the same haplogroup still exists in 3% of the Iroquois tribe of Indians to this day. But right now, let's make an interesting point. No doubt they were giants in the past. Their skeletal remains shows that they were 8 to 16 feet tall. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. And from what I understand, there's whole sections of the Smithsonian, the archives, I mean the Vatican archives, that have all these giant skeletons down there in the Smithsonian. They just don't know what to do to show them the humanity because it doesn't fit with what they're trying to tell us about Earth history. But so my point is right now the 3% of the Iroquois Indians that have haplogroup X are no longer giants. So something has been happening very quickly, actually. Within a few generations, genetic work was done to reduce the stature of the Nephilim so they didn't stick out like a sore thumb. There's no other way around it. When you understand the Anunnaki are master geneticists, it's not that crazy. And really, it's the only thing that even can answer that question of how come haplogroup X, the skeletal remains, are tall giants, and right now they're not. And as I said, I'm an Iroquois Indian, and they told me I'm Nephilim, the Anunnaki themselves, and I'm not a giant. So I think that's an interesting point in itself. But where you find this haplogroup X is everywhere that Edgar Cayce stated that the Atlanteans or the Poseidians or the Inkyites went on this planet is where you find haplogroup X. So his own predictions have been verified in 1997, which, like I said, it's not that long ago. Mm-hmm. So this is a whole brand new bed of information, and I'm really excited because let me find this on my Facebook wall. This just hit the news. So first of all, let's just make it clear. This has been hidden. This ancient America's history. We've been told that nothing was happening here before Christopher Columbus arrived. And obviously, this is throwing that history book upside down, you know, that's just not true whatsoever. But my point is, it's been withheld from humanity, this information. No ifs, ands, or buts. So first of all, we get this just recently. History's got it all wrong. Scientists now say the Serpent Mound is as old as Aristotle. Said that the mound is actually older than the dirt that sits on top of it, is one of their quotes from these scientists. But beyond that, this was such a huge revealing to me is that the lost city of Cahokia, archaeologists has uncovered Native America's Indian sprawling metropolis. And if anyone goes to my Facebook wall, I got it right there on my wall, and you can see this. Right on the Mississippi River, it was a complex of the mound builders who it is truly metropolis, you know. They show pictures of the mounds that are still there that match the size of the pyramids in Chichen Itza in Mexico. You know, they're monstrous, and they have photographs. So something, this is in the Daily Mail, by the way. You know, this is the UK, one of their biggest newspapers. So something has changed from the inside that this information is now being released. And I do believe it's the revealing of the Nephilim, because you have the DNA testing, you have you know, Edgar Cayce's input, but now you have my own involvement with already being revealed to the world that my blood is normal human blood. And so what they found out is haplogroup X was here long before haplogroup A, B, C, and D, and E was ever here. So truly we're uncovering who the mound builders were and who the Native American Indians' ancient ancestors were, which is the Nephilim, and proven in height of giant statues, proven in my own contact with the Anunnaki. And I think it's just fascinating how, first of all, this blows my mind, though, because like I said, I live in East Lake.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, how is it that I was adopted and I'm their messenger and I happen to be at the home, the first location where they settled and it was home base.
Yeah.
And I asked, again, like telepathy up to the big man upstairs, you know, I'm like, this is almost like I feel like I'm being punked. You know what I mean? Like, it's just one thing after another, like having a dream that I'm going to meet Steve Vai. And then the next day, find out it was a vision more or less, you know. And in it, he said, welcome aboard. And the next day, I had this crazy, like, nudging to go to Vai.com because I just felt that there was going to be this weird synchronicity waiting for me. And I thought, because in this vision, he was doing a song called There's a Train That's Leaving. It was really spiritual. And I thought, wouldn't it be weird if he was working on a song called There's a Train That's Leaving? So I go to Vai.com and said, enter the Steve Vai Ibanez Guitar Challenge. And the fur on the back of my neck went up. I knew I was going to win that contest before I even recorded a note because I just met him in a vision and he said, welcome aboard. You know, and sure enough, I did win the contest. And so why I'm telling you all of this is it's kind of like the same feeling to me or meeting Dan Reed, one of my biggest heroes growing up as a musician, meeting Joe Satriani, meeting the Anunnaki, meeting all this stuff unfolding. And it's really it's not my doing. You know what I mean? It's just happening. Yeah. So but it makes me kind of feel like it's too perfect. I feel like, you know, like. Am I just being punked on a cosmic level or something? So I asked them, how can it be that I'm in East Lake? It would have had to meant it was preordained before I was even born that I would be adopted and my adoptive parents would be living here in East Lake. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And they said, you don't get it. It's like, first of all, because I said, you know, I'm not choosing these things in my life. It's not like I'm making them up. And they said, sometimes it chooses you. Which was interesting. And they said, you need to understand that these things are evidence of all that is intertwining and involvement in your life. It proves who you are, you know, and you're just going to have to be okay with it and learn to roll with it because it feels pretty strange, you know what I mean? So right now I'm working with the East Lake Historical Society to release all of this information to the media, you know? And I'm really excited about it because obviously, and you know who has this knowledge still to the day is the Native American Indians. That's what the Star Knowledge Conference is all about. They've decided to share it. This is time. And I can tell people who want to look into this, if they look into a book called Star Symbols by Chief Golden Light Eagle, it's truly not a book he wrote. It's a gathering of information that's been handed down through the Indian cultures for thousands of years of truly what's going on here. And it's beautiful. I own the book now. Highly say look into that. But, yeah, so...
That's awesome. Well, what we'll do, we'll wrap up the show at the moment. I'd love to get you back in the future. We've gone for over an hour and a half, and I think this is going to be a lot of information for a lot of people to take in. I'm loving the synchronicities and how everything's connected. But if possible, I'd love to get you back on the show soon, if that's okay.
Oh, anytime. You know what? Like I said, I was really looking forward to speaking with you because I always, to me, it's like me and you are just on the phone having a conversation with like-minded individuals and like a friend, you know?
Yeah.
So I was really, it's the same deal with anytime. We'll let some more things unfold and we'll get back together and talk about what's happening. And like I said, I'd like to get you over here to the States and, you know, because I know you got some cool stuff happening. Christopher Turner, right? I'm really looking forward to those documentaries.
Yeah, we've both been working with him, yeah.
Yes, indeed. And
definitely.
Yeah, so it's cool stuff. So I'm really – anytime, Peter, and I really I enjoy our talks.
Yeah, thank you so much. We'll wrap it up there. I'll have links to your website. And just send us through that 4 megabyte
picture of the geometry from the sound, and I'll bang it up.
Yeah.
Michael, thank you very much, and we'll keep in contact, mate.
Perfect.
Sweet. Cheers, mate. Bye-bye.
Have a great one. Happy Thanksgiving.
Yeah. Cheers, mate. You too. Have a good one.
Peace. Bye.